Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. On again, off again, you could get whiplash going back and forth, whether it's tariffs or federal jobs. We get back with voices on the front line. We learn about disaster recovery and building community locally and globally. We introduce you to Taproot Earth, born out of the devastating Hurricane Katrina, which hit the continent almost 20 years ago. We hear from our lieutenant governor, who thinks tariffs could mean opportunity for Hawaii's agricultural industry. And we look at what's in your cart. We make a stop in Kalihi. And on the Manu Minute, we meet a chatty red bird. Plus, we talk with a master ceramicist about heat and pressure, how a centuries-old Japanese art has flourished in Hawaii. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's a tale of three workers, specifically conservation workers with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who we've been checking in with during this transition of a new administration. Here with the story is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what were you able to find out?
Yeah, so in mid-February, we saw these mass firings of probationary employees across a handful of federal agencies. And around that time, I got in touch with three people, all of whom were fired from the same team at the Kauai Wildlife Refuge Complex, which is run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I've been just keeping in touch with them by phone and text over the last 2 months to get an understanding of what it's been like for federal workers who were so abruptly let go as part of the Trump administration's effort to downsize the government. And they've said that it's been extremely tumultuous. It's been really, really confusing, so much so that only one person who was offered their job back, all three of these workers were offered eventually a chance to return to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Only one person has decided to go back, and that person is Bryn Weber, who has been working as a biologist at the refuges.
There was absolutely no warning. My boss didn't know that I was being fired until 30 minutes before I knew. I was actually having car trouble and had just texted my coworkers to let them know I was running late and I had to go grab some oil in Kapa'a. And so my boyfriend was driving me into Kapa'a to get some oil, and they said, well, hold on a second, like check your phone, because there's a Teams meeting that's been put on all of our calendars for every probationary employee. So I was like, oh dear. As soon as I heard that, I was like, wow, I think I'm about to be fired.
Wow, that's pretty brutal.
Yeah, so that was Valentine's Day. And something that really struck me, when I called Weber for the first time about 2 weeks later, she picked up the phone from the middle of the Hanalei Refuge, where she was doing a survey for avian botulism, and that's a disease that's really deadly to water birds. And if she had been doing that work just 2 weeks prior, she wouldn't have been a volunteer. She would have been a paid research biologist, but she went back because of how important she felt her work was. And working at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife specifically had been this lifelong dream.
Honestly, it was my dream job of all dream jobs. Like, I, you know, when you're in undergrad and you're in all of your schooling and field jobs, everyone, or most people, I would say, they put the Fish and Wildlife Service up on this pedestal. Like, you know, they're permanent jobs. They have funding. I won't say they're well-funded, but if you get one of those jobs, you know, you could know that you're working closely with the Endangered Species Act, an endangered species. So, yeah, it was just absolutely incredible. And I was building my life around that job and didn't have a plan B or C, because that was it.
Wow. So to have this passion for this job and career that she was building, and then to have it pulled out right from under her.
Exactly. And that was shared by Daniela Casillas, who worked on her team at Fish and Wildlife Service as well. She told me she had dreamed of working there since college, and she got this chance to apply for a position in November 2023, and then she started working in the field last August. And then, just like Weber, she was told to log on to a Teams meeting on Valentine's Day, and she was fired.
It was our Region 1 director that was leading the meeting. You could tell that they were pretty mortified to share the news. They really made sure to say, this is nothing that you did wrong. We chose you because we needed you for this role that you're in. Again, this is nothing you did wrong.
Still, tough to hear.
Yeah, and the other thing that Casillas got later was an email from the Federal Office of Personnel Management that explained her termination like this.
I have it here in front of me. It says, the department has determined your knowledge, skills, and abilities do not meet the department's current needs, and it is necessary and appropriate to terminate during your probationary period your appointment to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Do we know what she's going to do now?
So Casillas has decided not to return to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In this brief window of stability that she had, she started planning for a future, and she and her husband, who live on Kauai, bought a vacant lot. They made plans to build a home, and she just doesn't feel like she would be on sure enough footing if she went back to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as much as she wants to. And, you know, when she was reflecting on that communication that she got from the Office of Personnel Management, she said it was really ironic to be told that her knowledge, skills, and ability didn't meet the department's needs, because just a month before this, remember, the United States federal government had been flirting with the idea of a shutdown, and her office was making a plan as to who would stay on if that happened. And she was told that she'd be the only person from the biology team who would continue to work while everyone else was furloughed because of the how essential her work was. So it was a complete 180 in the orientation that superiors had to her work.
Wow.
And the last person that I've been in touch with in this team is Stephen Minimishin, who, like Casillas and Weber, found out he was fired on Valentine's Day. But when he was invited to that team's meeting with probationary workers who were being fired, his first reaction was, wait, why am I here? He had been with the agency since 2019. But here's what happened. Last year, Minimishin had gotten a job promotion, and because of that, he was lumped in with recent hires who had less than a year on the job, and he was terminated. And this was devastating to him because he had left a pretty lucrative career in the construction industry in order to work in conservation, which he said just better aligned with his values. And in this new position that he had in Fish and Wildlife, he had this plan.
My biggest overall goal was to hire locally. When I started in Fish and Wildlife, I knew one other person who was from Hawaii. So I felt like it was going to take me 15, 20 years to kind of establish this culture of trust for the federal government that has seemingly been lost. And I thought I was in a position of making change. It's like I just got that ripped away.
So is he going to go back to construction?
He is. So he has decided to leave conservation as a paid employee for now. He has taken a job with a construction company that's actually based in Alaska. And he still plans to volunteer to provide services in that way, to be a member of the community that supports conservation. But he doesn't feel like under this administration, he would have enough security to return. And this was a real push and pull as I spoke with these folks over the course of 2 months. They were all really interested in the idea of going back, but they were also very concerned about if they went back, would they just be fired again? And as I stated at the top, there was a judge, a federal judge, who said, hello, you cannot fire all of these probationary workers in one fell swoop like this. That order has actually been paused by the U.S. Supreme Court. Similarly, a separate order which said it was unlawful to fire federal workers, probationary employees, has also been reevaluated at the appeals court. So there's still a lot of litigation that's occurring around this issue, and many federal workers are unsure if they return whether or not they'll be able to stay.
That's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah. I find it especially heartbreaking to speak with Stephen Minimishin because he was someone who really wanted to be kind of a bridge of trust between the community and the federal government. He understands that the federal government, which is the second largest landowner in Hawaii, it doesn't always have the trust of the community in the work that it does, but he really believed in the work that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service specifically was putting into overseeing and stewarding these refuges on Kauai. It's more than 1,000 acres. But Keith now says that aside from the trustees and his coworkers and even in his regional departments, at the highest level of government, he has lost trust in what the federal administration is doing. And he went back to the refuge a couple of weeks after he had been fired. And he said, being back that first time, it was just heartbreaking for him.
The best I can compare it to. Going through the craziest breakup of your life and then going to your ex's house. It's kind of how I felt. I was like, somebody that I loved, and I feel like I'm just here to pick up my stuff. Actually, I was using this analogy because I don't know how else to compare it to. Because like, I deeply love our refuge, like with all my heart. Like, it's the love of my life, right?
Yeah, you can hear that in his voice, just the disappointment.
Yeah, so it's something to consider, right, when we're thinking about the future of conservation in Hawaii, specifically for federal workers. If they're given the opportunity to return, will they think it's worth it?
Yeah, yeah. But even if they do bring them back, right, the damage is done. People who were key have left, so.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much, Savannah, for highlighting this.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HFAIR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tune in to HPR2 on Monday at 8 p.m. for another in our series of Hawaii Symphony Orchestra Masterworks concerts. We'll hear Symphony No. 41, The Jupiter, by Mozart. We'll also hear Kaumea Nui Progressions by John Magnusson, Songs for Voice, Viola, and Strings by Brahms, Silver Pilgrimage by Alan Hovhaannis, and Shrunken Symphony by Kurt Schwerzik. That's Monday at 8 p.m. on HPR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Challenge of disaster recovery. Hawaii has certainly had its share in recent times. But today we highlight a group born out of a hurricane that hit the Gulf Coast 20 years ago this August. Hurricane Katrina marked a turning point for disaster response, and Taproot Earth is a nonprofit aimed at empowering underserved communities following disasters. Its work is being highlighted at the University of Hawaii Better Tomorrow series later tonight. And this morning we hear from Anthony Giancaterino, strategic partner for Taproot Earth, who says the group has been expanding its reach and has been working with the Catholic Church. You may recall Pope Francis wrote a letter to the earth calling on us to rethink our relationship to the environment. Recovery and resilience is what Taproot Earth is all about.
So when Katrina 20 hit, my co-partner Colette Pichon Battle started working with communities regionally, you know, crossing from Louisiana to Mississippi, which to many people was regional work, but to Clinton, as she tells her story, was going checking on her neighbors. But the idea was, at the time, really to work to support communities around law and policy and organizing to address disaster recovery. Over the years, that work has evolved and changed, and Taproot Earth formed in 2022 as a sunset organization. So we only exist until 2030. And our main focus really is about how do we invest in the leadership of communities to build governance and create collective stewardship of resources like water, energy, and land through democratic processes of consensus and collective decision-making. What we learn out of Katrina and what we learn in many disasters, climate or political, when systems fail, if people don't know their neighbors, if they can't make decisions together in practice, there's a huge gap and vacuum in governance. And so part of our mission as an organization is, how do we address environmental justice and climate justice through a governance lens?
And then I have to ask, so do you get any federal funding?
We do not. We had the foresight to not take the IRA dollars.
And so you're going to be whole as far as you can tell. I mean, you're not going to have the rug pulled out from under you in that
respect. No, but a lot of our partners do. So we are in a position where we work with a lot of community partners from the Gulf South all the way up through Appalachia that were in position for federal dollars and then now are really struggling. And so we are trying to provide some support, whether it's through technical assistance, connections to folks, really trying to build a much more collaborative way of fundraising and development to support organizations, and even sharing some skill sets among our staff. So having some staff support organizations where they were going to hire someone and now they can't because of the decrease in dollars.
Yeah, and it must be hard because whether you're working in a community because of something impacted by climate change, if this administration is targeting programs that mention climate, you know, equity is a big deal and you don't want to be an organization that is going to have the rug pulled out from under you and then your work completely comes to a halt.
Correct. As an organization, we ground in Black liberation and Indigenous sovereignty. And we got some questions like, are you all going to stop saying that? We're like, no, this is why we're here. We are committed to that and we will continue to commit to that. But it does mean we have to be more creative, create more ways of solidarity and mutual fundraising to be able to sustain. So our mission hasn't changed with the change of administrations, but some of the tactics and how we need to move is always under constant assessment for the well-being of our team, our partners, and just the work. What we're trying to do, I think, as an organization is try to get out of some of these binaries of the political reality that we're in and really think about how do we work together at a local to regional level and reimagine our systems. So it's like, how do you build, well, the house is burning, right? How do you attend to the material needs of the people and get them out of the house so they have water, they have shelter, and they have safety, but also build a new house that people can live in that is just better suited? So in a lot of ways, what we're trying to do is, despite all that is happening, we are trying to work with communities to create a new way of the world. So that doesn't mean we're ignoring what's happening, but it does position our conversations to what we call the liberation horizon, which really is, what would it take to build a world where we can live, rest, and thrive in the places we love? What do we need to have in place? What does that mean for water? What does that mean for land? What does that mean for how we need to build across communities, across difference? And that's where we kind of hone in these moments.
So talk about maybe some projects that you've got underway.
We're doing a lot of work right now in the Gulf South to Appalachia, spanning 17 states. And part of that was, these are two regions that have had the most extraction in energy. So coal and gas in Appalachia, oil and gas in Louisiana. It's also where a lot of the hydrogen hubs and petrochemical buildouts are happening. And it's also a deep story of long resistance, whether it's the Black freedom struggle in the South to labor struggles in Appalachia, where you have a lot of opportunity for people to build solidarity across race and class, but addressing some of the same challenges around corporations and extraction. So we've been building a climate action strategy and connecting these 17 states together. We have about over 120 organizations committed and moving and making practices of collective decision making through a community controlled fund. So how to use money and resources and move it to the community as it goes, or how to come up with priorities around how do you stop the extraction of fossil fuels to building climate resilient housing. So that's one project, is the Gulf South to Appalachia formation. And then globally, we actually have been doing a long historical run around global climate reparations. And we have a global climate reparations initiative. And for the last 3 years in particular, we have been working with communities to create a community working statement on what global climate reparations is.
Yeah, how does that work? Explain to our audience.
It starts with a lot of conversations with partners we know, people we've been referred to. Actually, just a shout out to Dr. Maxine Burgett from University of Hawaii, who coined the legal framework for global climate reparations. So that actually informed a lot of our work. But we run these processes called people's movement assemblies. And that is when you bring people together. It could be for a day, it could be for a week, or it could be over like months, depending on how you set them up. But it's a process where you facilitate communities coming together to make decisions or to define things. So we did a global climate reparations governance assembly where people came together in five languages from over 250 people from over 30 countries in five languages. So you come together and say, here's what climate reparations mean to the front lines, rooted in Black liberation and Indigenous sovereignty. And we did that in Kenya this past year of 2024. And we came out with a beautiful working statement, which is now being applied to the climate talks, both at COP29 and will be applied to in Brazil and COP30. We actually took that working statement to the Catholic Church in Rome, and we convened about 100 leaders, both from the Catholic Church, but also from the frontline communities who are not Catholic, to talk about, in the Jubilee year of the Catholic Church, how can the Church both acknowledge some of the harms that it has done in the past, but also lead with moral example around what reparations could look like in the climate context. And Pope Francis, with his writings and with his current guidance of the church, there's a real opportunity to be like, here's an institution that has benefited from extraction over its history, but is in a position to actually lead and show how an institution that is 2,000 years old can actually help lead on repair, working with communities. So.
Yeah, well, I think this pope, you know, did write a letter, I think, right?
Two, yeah,
two letters. To the earth, right? Yeah.
He has been, it's been, I grew up Catholic, so.
Me too.
It is nice to be like, oh, there's a pope that a lot of what he says is in alignment with a lot of frontline communities are saying and my own beliefs. So it's been really great to see that. And we see this as an opportunity to, in a time where there's so much sorrow and sadness and despair, to see opportunities for hope and have people come together and say, we can do this. You know, so it's been powerful.
And so as far as reparations, can you point to something where you have been successful in achieving that or close to it?
We're getting there. You know, I think maybe just to take this example around the Catholic Church, when we convened people in Rome as part of this Jubilee convening, we had church leaders who were there both from the Vatican, but also from, you know, just the church institutions around the world and frontline communities. And what came through in this idea of reparations is you always have to start with an acknowledgement of a harm before you can even get to the repair. And in that convening, there was agreement from all sides that the church really does need to do a full acknowledgement of the harm created by the doctrine of discovery. And it has been done in Canada, but it's not been like worldwide. So I think in that sense, while it is not officially done yet, there was a lot of agreement and deep understanding across the board from institutional leaders and from community that is the first step that has to happen. And so I think getting there, we were able to use that climate reparations definition and just talk about acknowledgement, which is really critical. And people agreed, like, we do need to acknowledge. And then once you get that an acknowledgement, then it's about how do you actually make acts of repair, and then how do you make acts of solutions that can build a different world.
That would be big.
It would be huge, but it is, you know, again, it's... In the church, they have these jubilee years every 25 years, and this year is one, and the Pope has called for debt abolition, has called for a fund to support frontline communities by divesting from fossil fuels, and has called for the rights of migrants, and for the right to people to remain on their land, but also to be able to move. And we're like, if there's ever a moment now to talk about climate reparations in the church, it's this year, given that kind of mission and focus.
I happened to see something on 60 Minutes about Greenland and the indigenous people there. And it really gives you pause about, you know, what's important for that area and other people's interest in that area.
Correct. And even coming to Hawaii, too, just to hear the deep history and understand the long history that has taken place on this land that we're on right now is continually helps shape and inform how we need to move.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with just about your organization?
I think what I would just like to leave listeners to is, while things feel very heavy right now, and they are, there's a lot happening. It's constant climate disasters all over. There is real concern around the political environment. You know, I have three daughters. I'm very concerned about their future. But we have to lean in with hope and community. You know, in these moments, what we have found is a lot of people keep resorting back to technology or going back to just individual hyper-individualism and turning inward. And that's what gets us into these problems. And I think just going out there and finding your community, having conversations around what's happening to the water in your community, what's happening to the land, having conversations around what would happen if the school needs something, like how do you all come together? Just at a base level, finding community and connecting with community is the first step to any solution. And so I just want to encourage people, anytime you're feeling stress and anxiousness and despair, just turn to the community, because anytime there's a disaster, it's the first 72 hours of a climate disaster that is the most important. And the people that step in is not FEMA. And it's not the state, it's community. Across the political spectrum, across economic spectrums, like, community is the group that shows up. And so if we don't practice that community, it won't exist. So I think the encouragement is practice community, have dinners, have meals, have the hard conversations. And that's what we do with our formations and our communities as well.
Taproot Earth.
Taproot Earth.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming down and talking with us, Anthony.
And thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
We've been hearing from Taproot Earth's Anthony Giancarino. The group's founder, Colette Pichon-Battle, will be the featured speaker at a talk at the University of Hawaii Kaikendal Auditorium on the Manoa campus at 6:30 p.m. tonight.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Here's one way to get more involved with Hawaii Public Radio. Apply to join our Community Advisory Board. The feedback from our volunteer board helps us shape our programs and events. Neighbor Island listeners are especially encouraged to apply. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB. Deadline is May 16th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Imports and exports have been top of mind this month as businesses try to make sense of President Trump's threat of tariffs. One group of people that could come out on top are Hawaii's farmers. That's according to Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke, who recently returned from a visit to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the nation's capital. It's the second time a Hawaii delegation has ever visited. Luke spoke with HPR's Mark Ladau about why restrictions on exports could be changing under the Trump administration.
After the new administration went in, we were going back and forth about whether we should take another delegation just to feel out the new administration and feel out what is the temperature for the new USDA secretary. And we were pleasantly surprised that we had great feedback. I know right now it's a very chaotic time for many folks dealing with the federal government, but that shouldn't prevent us or scare us from continuing to reach out to see if there are ways that we can continue to support agriculture. And just to highlight and just to make a case that, hey, Hawaii is still here. We can play the role of import replacement because a lot of times the fruits and vegetables and products that the continental U.S. are getting are out of the country. So why is it that it's okay for them to have fruits and vegetables from out of the country, but it makes it really hard for us to be able to export our fruits and vegetables to the continental U.S. So those are conversations that we want to continue to have.
Hawaii is sort of treated like territories, and for all the territories, it's basically prohibited to move plant material for like pest reasons, aside from like a certain list.
We now have significant barriers on exporting our goods. And if we want to be in a place where we are looking at economic diversity and we're looking at alternative industries, we have to support our ag industry. There are different opportunities in the state of Hawaii where we are producing, but it's the export ability and it's the even the export ability between the islands because of different costs or different factors that is preventing us from moving to the next step. And so let's go back to our relationship between the state of Hawaii and the continental U.S. Because of our location in the Pacific, we play a significant role for national security, basically for the support and protection of the rest of the nation. But when we look at some of the export restriction, they're almost treating us as a territory, even if we're a state. One of the things that Nathan Trump, one of the people in the delegation, said was things like avocado, things like pineapple, things like lime, which has a tougher outer shell, should not be treated in the same way as a fruit that has a fleshy outer shell, only because if folks are concerned about fruit fly infestation, we need to work with USDA and our research institution about, okay, maybe the fruit flies is a problem with certain fruits, but there's lack of research on whether there's also fruit fly problems for a hard shell. And you know, I mean, if you kind of look at it from a common sense approach, you would think a fruit fly wouldn't be interested in a hard shell compared to a soft shell. So I think there are different kind of conversation we need to have, but we have to have those conversation with USDA and say, hey, let's step back and let's look at what you folks are trying to protect. And first of all, treat us like a state, and then let's not treat all fruits and vegetables the same way. We have huge opportunities, and we have things that we grow in the state, including avocados, including macnut, including limes, including pineapples, that should not be treated in the same way like many of the other fruits and vegetables. So those are the things that we want to talk about. The other thing that we would like to have a discussion with USDA, and we have started to at least tease out some of the issues, is, for instance, are there opportunities, because we know the federal government is cutting a lot of the positions. If you go to the airport, we just got a notice from the Department of Transportation that the lines at the airport expect it to be longer, only because they are anticipating that we are not going to have as many ag inspector workers. Are there opportunities where we can have a discussion about, okay, if you're going to cut some of the positions and cut programs, can we take on that responsibility, or can we do a pilot out of certain island? For instance, I mean, I always think that Kauai is such a good pilot because we're dealing with limited number of people, limited number of travelers. And so if we can start from Kauai or another island where those flights, as opposed to going through the ag inspections, if we can do a different way, whether it's through spot check by dogs or do a random check, so that we can relieve the pressure of the reduction in force and reduction in services. But for us, I think we need to adapt and we need to be creative in ensuring that we comply with biosecurity regulation, but at the same time, not disrupt the lives of our people and our citizens.
When it comes to exports, how much could be sent out and what kinds of crops specifically?
Right now, there's basically very little conversation about what are some of the ways that we can increase exports, what are some of the ways that we can adjust our biosecurity regulations, whether it's import or export, and what are some of the products that the U.S. market or the world market would be interested in. The continental U.S. imports 90% of limes from the world. You know, Maipono and Maui are growing a lot of limes, but for them, because they are limited in their ability to export to the U.S. market, it doesn't make sense, economic sense, for them to grow their inventory if they continue to have these restrictions with the continental U.S. So if we can figure out what are some of the products that are not susceptible to our fruit flies, or the fruit flies, there will be less infestation of fruit flies in these fruits, and then we can put research behind it and then work with USDA on a pilot program where let's try some of these things and let's see, let's try to do data gathering on the export side and the import side and continue to work together on some of these issues. And I think those are the conversation that we never really had, or we had very little conversation. But I think now, because of the focus on tariffs and because the focus really on import replacement, Hawaii could play a role in feeding or, you know, providing goods and services to the continental U.S. that we never really had before.
That was Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke talking with HPR's Mark Ladau about her delegation's recent visit to Washington, D.C., where they met with USDA officials about Hawaii's agricultural priorities. You know, we thought we'd check in to see how the headlines have been affecting your lives and your budgets. And what better way to do that than at the grocery store? The Conversation's D.W. Gibson set out to answer one of the most basic questions when it comes to spending. What's in your shopping cart? Outside Paloma Market in Kalihi, he met Jean Hing. Here's what Jean had to say.
Today, for mostly snack, my snack, and some for my lunch.
Have you noticed when you were shopping today, different prices from, say, maybe a few weeks ago?
Yes.
Were there specific products that you noticed the prices going up on?
I think mostly everything. Everything just is going up. I just went to Costco. Costco, same thing. Just, you know, everything going up.
So this is a Paloma Market, which is a Korean market. What kind of items are missing?
I tried to get cup noodle. And most, I just got it about 3 weeks ago, and they don't have a brand what I like.
So I don't know if you've been following headlines about tariffs. And so are you thinking about that at all as you think about shopping?
Yes. And so I tried to buy more canned goods to put in my pantry. So that's what I got in from Costco. Canned goods. You know, it can last longer, right?
Yeah, so trying to get more shelf-stable stuff that will last a long time and then stocking up the pantry as best you can now, right?
Yes.
So it sounds like you anticipate that prices will be going higher.
It's going to be higher, yeah. It's going to be higher and higher, higher until Trump is gone. Sorry I say that, you know, yeah.
Any other thoughts on your mind about the economy or shopping these days?
Well, riches don't care about people like us, you know. Currently, politicians are all rich, yeah. So they don't care. They don't care price going up. So only people like us and ordinary people suffer. So that's my main concern. Wish, you know, they care for public, you know, real people, not rich, you know.
That was HBR's D.W. Gibson, who spoke with Jean Hing outside a Paloma Market recently. How's the state of the economy affecting your shopping habits? What's in your shopping cart? And where do you think we should go next? Leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217 or email us talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and we've got a ruby red gem of a bird for you today, the Northern Cardinal. This songbird has been calling Hawaii home since the early 20th century, so you're probably already familiar with its call, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. We've got your Manu Minute. Here's Professor Patrick Hart from the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Northern cardinals are among the most common and recognizable birds in towns, backyards, and even some forests across Hawaii. Introduced to Hawaii in 1929, they're also one of the most abundant birds in North America, though they still don't occur naturally in most of the western states. About 9 inches long from the tip of their bill to the end of their tail, males are a vivid red color with a red crest, a black mask and chin, and a large, bright orange bill. All of these colors are obtained from eating carotenoid pigments in their food. The females also have the bright orange bill, but otherwise are mostly brown, with a bit of red on their wings, tail, and crest. Juveniles can sometimes be mistaken for females, however their gray-black bills don't turn orange until they're about 3 months old. Males advertise their territorial boundaries and try to impress females with a large variety of songs throughout the year. Most of us in Hawaii have heard these songs, even though we might not realize it was northern cardinals that were making them. See if you can recognize any of these common northern cardinal songs. Also known in Hawaiian as Manu Ula Ula, or redbird, northern cardinals use their large nutcracker-like bills to open large seeds and fruits and to consume a variety of insects. They're among the few non-native birds that can commonly occur in our native forests and are even common in our low-elevation forests where there's too much mosquito-transmitted avian malaria for the native birds to survive. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native wildlife and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
Next in On Point's special series, Falling Behind.
Black boys, including my son, he is looked at as a problem versus an asset. And that follows them from pre-K into adulthood.
Reimagining Black boyhood and the schools that are doing it right. It's the latest in our week-long exploration, Falling Behind, the Miseducation of America's Boys. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
A traditional Japanese art form is on display in downtown Honolulu. Raku, a type of Japanese pottery, shares the spotlight with printmaking at a show at the Downtown Art Center. The show's name is Heat and Pressure, and it features the work of the Hawaii craftsman as judged by master ceramicist Yukio Ozaki. Ozaki came to Hawaii in 1973 with $20 in his pocket, and he took a summer ceramics class at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He ended up teaching fine arts for decades at Chaminade University and has been named a living treasure of Hawaii by the Honpa Hongwanji Mission of Hawaii. Ozaki spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his own path and Hawaii's tradition of raku ceramics.
I guess I was always art focused, knowing I was no good in mathematics. I love physics, but the math was no good. So I went in Japan college days, I had to take a cultural direction for my future study. And during those days, I was much into flower arrangement in Japan. Through that influence, I really loved all types of flower arrangement vessels in ceramics. So that was my idea of interesting ceramics when I started at UH. And because of my certain background, hobby class through YWCA on Richard Street then, I had certain skills developed to do the beginning things. And that became the pulling introduction to the instructors later I met and getting their suggestion to see if I can make it to the graduate school. And so flower arrangement, I must say, was the key value in art that I had been earlier introduced, and to this day, there are many things that makes me realize that laid the foundation of my art understanding.
And so talk a little bit about the evolution of this pottery in Hawaii.
Hawaii. When I was at UH and then working on my grad school time already, 1977, one guy in undergrad, he and one of the professors, visiting professors from San Jose State, started talking about the Raku Festival on the beach in California. And it was extremely popular. But after about 2 years, the state banned it because I'm sure they made trash the yard everywhere. While it was going on there, why don't we do it too? And so a group of much into ceramics people and UH and other institutions and then pottery groups got together, and then Hawaii Craftsman as a leadership started organizing this Raku Hōlauleā. And then first place was Kualoa Beach. And we continued there, I believe, 3 years, then got kicked out because there was a lot of problem because we fired right onto the grass those days. So today, it's not allowed. Everything has to be kiln, has to be lifted not to burn the ground. Also, one of the senior groups hired a contractor, used a front loader to dig out the ground to do a pit firing. And after firing up Andy, during the firing, 20 feet flame went up. After the firing was done, you know, over the weekend, they buried it with their power shovel and then didn't water it extinguished. So it smoldered weeks, days after, and then killed quite a few iron trees. And so Kuala Lumpur Beach caretaker just banned us. And after that, we went to Waimanalo and then on to current Camp Moklea. And so we do behave much better, I'm sure. Yep. But that's how it happened. And at the time, it was enormous popularity. About 34, 35 groups gathered. It's hard to compare what happens today compared to what was then. A lot of fun things happen, a floating pot competition in the ocean, Kaneohe Bay, or pot drop competition, huge tower, and then put a pot and fire, and then let the wood tower burn down, and pot drops, and then which one breaks first, and stuff like that. But the main thing was what was going on from the international influence of what Raku was. The very simple, low fire, about 1750 to 1800 fire, and then low fire glaze on it, and then pull it out when it's red hot, and then in Raku, what we know today, to change the color, we do post-firing reduction. After firing into glaze mill, they take it out and then put it into combustible material. It used to be dug up ground, but today all in trash cans filled with hay, paper, mostly paper, and some people oil rags and stuff, messy. And then burn it, smoke it up, closing lid. And then by doing that, what we call reduction. That's what contemporary Raku is being done, Raku firing.
And so the Downtown Art Center show is running currently. I believe it's called Heat and Pressure, and you served as judge for one portion of it.
Yes.
I was wondering from you if you could talk about a few of the pieces that you judged and you liked and describe them for our audience.
Yes, I'm glad you asked, because then I didn't have much chance to explain, and I feel sorry, because traditional Raku doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. So what I chose, a very small number of pieces were eligible from the categorical requirement. I picked only 6 pieces. The most wonderful was garden lantern, like small piece, maybe a foot and plus, and then lid, light section, and then leg section. Other things I noticed was one of the potters, ceramic artist, makes these cats, wonderful cats. And then so I translated from the Chinese lion onto cat form, and then that was wonderful. Also, only done in black and white, so it was perfect. Another one was a sake bottle, very contemporary blocks of clay put together. Others were, there was a wonderful greenish brown bowl, tea bowl. Probably that's the most traditionally appropriate one. But as for awarding point, I put more importance on creativity.
And so all of this is currently on view, which is, it should be exciting for listeners. Lastly, I wanted to ask you about the future of this art form in Hawaii. How's it been to recruit younger folks?
It's really exciting form, so I hope it continues. It's one of the activities Hawaii's art scene is proud of to the world. Nowhere in the world does this. California led it at the beginning, but they don't do it in the way we do. And it's so valuable to pull the interest of the potters together or artists together, or people who have no idea, you know, saying, oh, hey, something like that is going to go on. And it perks up the interest of the public. Also, not cultural tradition of Raku, but tradition of what has happened in Hawaii to promote art and art interest as the main value in people's lives. Many discount that as nothing but, you know, very sadly, current legislature and state has voting down all of the input into art. Extreme mistake. It is bringing down the value of human being. That when you look at the whole history of human being, when clear sign of human started separating from early primates is when they started leaving. We call it art. It wasn't art. It was the necessity to connect with unknown. Their needs to express, to survive. It was a need for survival, for what? Human thinking. And that made the difference. And so legislature is making a tremendous mistake if they cut fundings in art. And I know every organization is thinking about survival, including state. So I see that, but art is nothing to be cut. And then Raku is one of the symbols we need to support. And then having tremendous fun and gathering kids, everybody come around and have a great time camping out. And we do it very safely too. And the great thing is it's fast. Most of the ceramics takes too long to keep the interest. This one happens as long as things are prepared by getting ready for bisquing and then glazing. It happens within a few hours. And it's a great way to promote the sudden interest and energy, excitement is rare, even among ceramics, that much energy in a short time. And a great way to find the joy.
Yukio Ozaki, thank you so much coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was ceramicist Yukio Ozaki talking with HR's Maddie Bender. The exhibition, Heat and Pressure, featuring work from Honolulu printmakers and Hawaii craftsman Raku Ho'olalea, will be on view at the Downtown Arts Center until April 26. The gallery is open most days from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Ozaki also spoke about the fascinating Japanese history of Raku, including tales of samurai and shoguns. We'll have additional excerpts from this interview on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear about a new funding source for Hawaii arts groups. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.